loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. 2018 is coming to an end, and we're going to take a look at the big stories. Immigration crackdown, the U.S. relations with North Korea, heightened confrontation with Iran, a trade war with China, the Mueller probe, the nonstop hysteria generated by politicians and the corporate-owned media against Russia, intensifying wildfires and global warming. We're going to spend our first hour reviewing some of the biggest stories of the year.
In the second hour of our Year in Review show today, we'll go over the year's trends in the economy and technology. First, as the year ends today, we'll discuss the biggest economic stories of 2018 and the big picture on our weekly series, False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Also, we're looking at the year in review in our regular segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Today, we look at the changes and developments in the world of technology over the past year. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our segment, The Year in Review. 2018 is coming to an end tonight. Immigration crackdown, U.S. relations with North Korea, heightened confrontation with Iran, a trade war with China, the Mueller probe, and the nonstop hysteria generated by politicians and the corporate-owned media against Russia, intensifying wildfires and global warming. We're going to spend our first hour reviewing some of the biggest stories of the year. We're joined from New York by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. And we're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Ted, Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
John, you know, I'm proud of our show. I think we've done a good job. Our producers of the show, Nicole Roussel, Walter Smolarek, John Kiriakou, Brian Becker, we have worked as a team. We've produced 2 hours of content every day, Monday through Friday. That's a lot of shows, 35 interviews a week. And we've covered all the stories, and we try to do it with, of course, partisanship, because we all have strong feelings and values and beliefs. But we've also done it objectively. And I think most importantly, we've been able to counter the narrative of the mainstream media, which I think also partisan, but without objective faculty.
That's
because
right.
There's a conclusion that they've already arrived at on all of these stories, Russiagate, Trump, Syria, Iraq, the border, you name it. Let's start, Ted Rawl, with you. We're looking at some of the big, big stories of the year and trying to pick out where we've picked out 10 of them. One of them is the idea that peace could break out in the Korean Peninsula, because who would have thought Donald Trump, who in September 2016 promised to annihilate North Korea, 8 months later met in Singapore with Kim Jong-un, and they signed the Singapore Declaration. Not that much has happened between the U.S. and North Korea since then, but a lot has happened between North Korea and South Korea. Anyway, peace breaking out in the Korean Peninsula, that would be a big story.
It would be a big story, and it may ironically represent a greater threat to Donald Trump's presidency than Russiagate and the Mueller investigation. To see the way that the mainstream media and members of both political parties react to any kind of moves toward peace by Donald Trump, whether it's trying to negotiate warming of relations between North and South Korea, or trying to have less saber-rattling between the U.S. and Russia, or its withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The reaction is bipartisan and extremely hostile, and it's the only time that it's the only kind of thing that appears to be able to provoke a resignation based on principle, in this case, the principle that the U.S. should be at permanent war, as we saw with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis last week, and then also with another lower-ranking official in the State Department, who also resigned, and a lot of hay was made out of. So that's the big story here, is that we really do have a monolithic war party in the United States, and Donald Trump, to the extent that he is going against that narrative, is, I think, that's where he's really taking some major chances, and that it could imperil him and sort of indirectly lead to a threat to his presidency. I never like to use the term deep state, but it seems to apply here.
That's the voice of Ted Rawl, editorial cartoonist, award-winning cartoonist, my favorite cartoonist. Ted, I'm saying that not just because you're a frequent guest. You really are my favorite cartoonist because I'm a political person and I'm looking for a sharp, funny political humor.
Ted's not just some guy who sits at a table and draws cartoons. He's syndicated in 100 newspapers around the country, including some of the most important newspapers in the world. He's a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's a multiple-time winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. It's not just, you know, a guy sitting there doodling.
Yeah, we're very, very happy that Ted Rawl is with us. And we're also very happy that we have Jacqueline Lookman, who is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. She joins us every Friday in a segment here at Loud and Cleared called The Week in Review, and also on Wednesdays now, What's in the News, that's a midweek show. Jacqueline is the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation, as I mentioned. You can check out their live stream every week and on Facebook and YouTube. Jacqueline, you know, it's interesting what Ted Rawl said, that the thing that could become Donald Trump's undoing is the idea that he could be a peacemaker in Korea. That says a lot, and it made me remember, made me think about the fact that when Donald Trump actually sent 59 cruise missiles crashing into Syria over the unproved allegation that Syria had used chemical weapons, and he did it while he was having dessert with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, all the critics of Trump in the mainstream media said, now Trump is acting presidential. Remember that? I mean, that was when Trump got a reprieve, was when he started bombing people.
As we have said in Lookman Nation, and we've taken a lot of heat for this, but we've always said ever since he became president that he's kind of like a necessary evil in a lot of ways to show this country, to show the people in this country who is really in these political parties. We've been demonizing the Republicans for being a bunch of neocon war hawks. And we've always left the Democrats out of the equation as if they're supposed to be better than the Republicans, as if they're supposed to be more peace pursuing. But they've proven not to be. And it's not that it's not that they've never been that way. It's not that they've suddenly become, you know, warmongers. They've always been kind of warmongers. And I think they've gotten worse, or maybe over the past decade, only because there is so much money to be made in war. I mean, war, perpetual war is now America's number one industry, probably maybe running a close second to the carceral state, you know, to the corrections institution. We pretty much don't make anything anymore of great note, not like we used to. Our manufacturing base has been decimated, except for, you know, a little bit that we do in the auto industry. We're not the manufacturing giant that we used to be. So how America makes its money now is in these horrible wars that we continue to fight and in locking up people. But the people who are making the most money are the politicians who are continuing to push for these defense contractors to continue making more weapons, more advanced weapons systems, equipping the warfighter with more advanced outfits and supplies, and that's their sole purpose for existing. So when Trump decides, for whatever reason, you know what, we're not going to do this. We're going to try to broker peace with North Korea. We're going to pull the troops out of Syria. Maybe we need to get out of Afghanistan too. Then we see the people who are truly invested in perpetual war coming out of the woodworks. And then we find out who our politicians really are. So we can see that for sure. Trump is like this weird necessary evil, because if he weren't doing this, we really wouldn't have a clear view of who the warmongers are in Washington.
Walter Smolarek, you want to jump in?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one thing that was so discordant, I mean, I remember when the Singapore summit was happening, you know, in the United States, the media reception, like we've been talking about, the reception from the political elites was basically universally negative. I mean, in the most, you know, outrageous terms possible. But everywhere else in the world, people were overjoyed. People were so happy that this was happening because there's an appreciation for what the Korean people have gone through for, you know, the second half of the 20th century. I mean, Korea has been one country, right? It's one people. It's been a civilization for thousands of years, but it was brutally divided at the end of World War II against the will of the Korean people. There was what I would say is a genocidal war waged by the United States against Korea from 1950 to 1953, and China was involved in that war too. I mean, General Curtis LeMay said, and this is a direct quote, "We wiped out a fifth of their population," right? And General Curtis LeMay would know if that's true or not because he was in charge of the U.S. Air Force. I mean, it was this horrible division. You know, there's families who have, you know, never been able to meet each other. The division has been just so terrible for the Korean people. And finally, there was a glimmer of hope that that might be coming to an end. And so people naturally in Korea and outside of Korea, pretty much anywhere outside of the halls of power in the United States, were happy.
I was at the Singapore summit and I was struck by, I was with the Foreign Press Corps because Sputnik is Foreign Press Corps, not American Press Corps. And that was a great reward because it meant that I didn't have to travel with the U.S. media.
Right.
And the U.S. media were disgusting over there. Remember at the end of the summit, as Kim Jong-un and Trump shook hands, somebody, I don't know who it was, from the U.S. media yelled out, "Do you consider him your equal?" And I was like, wow, what an imperialist, racist formulation to yell at the middle of a signing ceremony. Like, how dare a leader from North Korea or from Korea be considered the equal of an American? And then I thought, wow, that's just disgusting. And the American media was very cynical. I was with mainly Asian reporters and Asian journalists who were part of the Foreign Press Corps in Singapore. They were very serious about it. They were very attentive to it. They were very hopeful about the summit. And then I looked at the Washington Post headline, "Kim Jong-un wants to be seen as Donald Trump's equal."
Imagine that.
You know, it's just flagrant racism. I mean, what other media talks like this? I mean, I don't see any other media using these kind of formulations. Go ahead, Ted.
No, they don't. And the thing is, they also don't. I've never seen any foreign media discuss talking to other countries, merely talking to other countries as a reward for behavior. I mean, it's not just at the core of imperialism and racism is also paternalism and patriarchy, right? Because it's this whole idea that, you know, the United States is the big daddy. We decide who's legitimate. And even getting to talk to big daddy is a reward. You know, never mind whether we actually make any concessions. Just the fact that we acknowledge that you exist and that you have a right to be taken seriously, which arguably any country has that inherent right. But I would say, obviously, a nuclear power has to be taken seriously, but any country does. But yeah, I've never heard this anywhere else. I've never heard even imperialist powers like France and England saying anything like this. It's the difference between our racism and their racism is that we really are like the old Palmolive commercial, man. We soak in it. We're unapologetic. We're brazen. We don't pretend not to be racist.
Let's move on to another story. The United States is in Syria illegally. It's in Syria illegally with U.S. troops and U.S. military bases and U.S. aircraft that have been bombing Syria. It's illegal because it's not authorized by the Syrian government. Syria has a government, the Assad government. It would be legal, maybe wrong, but legal if it was authorized by the UN Security Council, but it's not that either. And it's not legal because Syria has not attacked the United States, and thus the United States cannot assert the right of imminent attack and thus the requirement of self-defense according to the UN Charter. So on all three counts, this is an illegal occupation. Donald Trump said he was going to take 2,000 troops out of Syria last week. The defense secretary, Mattis, resigned. I mean, he didn't talk about Syria in his resignation letter, but it was right after the announcement. And then the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, oh my goodness, Nancy Pelosi went nuts and said it was one of the biggest political mistakes, or I think she said the biggest political mistake of a U.S. president in this century. And then I thought, like,
wow, a lot has happened in this century.
The nuclear destruction of two cities, or like.
No, that was last century.
This century.
Let's talk about 9/11, this century.
Post 9/11, Iraq War.
Walter, we're going to rename this segment called the Century
in Review.
But what about the invasion of Iraq?
Yeah.
Again, Trump now says, let's get out of Syria, and, or not really, because they're going to keep bombing Syria, but let's take U.S. troops out. And that is the thing that triggers all of this opposition.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, the thing that the Pentagon generals and the war makers always make the case for is that, well, you know, if we aren't over there, then the fight is going to come here to the United States. And we have to fight ISIS in Syria. We have to fight ISIS in Iraq. We have to carry out drone strikes all around the world. And so the reality, though, is that it's these U.S. interventions in the first place that have created, you know, the political circumstances where these types of forces can arise from. I mean, you know, like ISIS, right, is not organic to Syrian or Iraqi society. I mean, before the United States began its large scale interventions in those two countries. I mean, these were minor marginal forces, and they had secular nationalist governments where you had rights for religious minorities, rights for women's social programs. But the United States, you know, set out to shred all that. And so, you know, under these circumstances, these extreme reactionary organizations are bound to be set up. So the best thing the United States can do in reality is to get out of those countries.
Go ahead, Jackie Lookman.
Yeah, this is, the response of the Democrats to this decision by Trump has been so telling about who they really are. And the justifications that some people are now using, just people's hatred of Trump. And I am not saying at all that I like the guy at all. He's horrible. He's a horrible human being. He's a horrible president. At the same time, a broken clock is right at least twice a day, even if they're right, even if it's right for the wrong reasons. So you have Democrats who are condemning us removing ground troops from a situation that we legally shouldn't have been in. We can't win. And if we could win, we would have won by now. And they're using the excuse of, and it's true that, yes, the United States is abandoning the Kurdish people again. But these are the same people who I've never heard talk about the Kurdish people in the context of Syria or any other conflict ever before. So there's all this false posturing, all this false moral posturing that's coming from the Democrats in opposing this move to get troops out of Syria. That's so disingenuous, it's just really sickening to see how pro-war they are. But then again, remember, the Democratic Party supported a candidate who wanted to implement a no-fly zone over Syria in the first place, leading up to the 2016 election. So their response really isn't a surprise, but it doesn't make it any less sickening.
Yeah, let's talk about the Democrats a little bit more, because the Democrats, and this is another big story, we had a midterm election, and the Democrats won 40 seats, I think it was. They reclaimed the majority in the House.
40 seats with one seat still to be determined in North Carolina.
So, I mean, the House and the Senate have the greatest investigative capabilities. Obviously, this means there's going to be a ramping up of Russiagate. We want to get to Russiagate because, of course, that was, again, a dominant story in 2018. But when you think about who the Democrats are and whether this is going to mean anything good, especially from the point of view of war and peace, just think of who's going to be taking over as the chair House Foreign Affairs Committee. That's going to be Elliot Engel. I mean, Elliot Engel supported the move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem.
He's the very definition of a neoliberal foreign policy hawk.
Yeah. And he supported the Iraq War, like Gene Shaheen.
I think he sponsored anti-BDS legislation, too.
That would not surprise me one iota.
Yeah. So let's talk about whether, because people who are against Trump, as we are, but people who also support the Democrats, which we in the main don't, they were all about making the Democrats the new power in the House of Representatives, hopefully, they said, in the Senate in 2020, the president. What does it actually mean? What will it mean for war and peace? Ted Rall, you had mentioned about the role of the Democrats in the issues of war and peace. When we think back about the last 100 years, World War One, it was a Democrat. World War Two, it was Roosevelt, a Democrat. Korean War, Truman, a Democrat. Kennedy and Johnson for Vietnam, a Democrat. The idea that the Democrats are a pacifist or peace party, that just doesn't stand up.
And in fact, you remember in the 1996 presidential election, Bob Dole took it on the chin because he used the term Democrat wars when talking about previous armed conflicts.
Yeah, go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting conceit that so many liberals and even some progressives fall for the idea that we would see less foreign adventurism and interventionism if we were to, if Democrats were to be in charge. I mean, history doesn't bear that out. I mean, we don't have to go back to Woodrow Wilson. I mean, look at what happened when Barack Obama became president at a time of great economic crisis, when you would have expected him to focus on the worst economy since the Great Depression and getting people to stay in their homes or getting back into their homes and getting them jobs. You know, he was nominated during a month that was when Americans were losing 500,000 to 600,000 jobs per month. But instead of focusing on that, which he really didn't, he got us, he ended up reneging on George W. Bush's accommodation with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, leading ultimately to a drone strike that was carried out by the United States that led to Gaddafi's gruesome disembowelment on video, to which Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, famously laughed about. We came, we saw, he died. We turned Libya and then Syria by backing jihadis in Syria and in Libya, both into failed states that were both very moderate, secular Arab republics with socialist aspects before the Obama administration got there, and turned them into places where that have gone back hundreds of years culturally and economically. And it's become a complete disaster. So look, if the Democrats get in 2020 with a president and they get both houses of Congress, I would not expect anything to change. I think the military. Let's look at this. Just even in recent history, in terms of the House of Representatives, only one Democrat in the House of Representatives voted against the war against Afghanistan following 9/11, and that was Barbara Lee, who was recently kind of infamously snubbed by the Democratic caucus as caucus chair, even though she really was poised to have this position for a number of reasons, including seniority. But the fact is, I think she was not forgiven for that vote. Let's face it, she was the one vote who turned out to be right. It's been 17 years, and we've made no progress whatsoever in Afghanistan, except we have sure managed to kill a lot of Afghans and some Americans. It's disgusting. And I don't know what it's going to take to get liberals and progressives, a lot of progressives realize it, but too many don't realize it, to know that progressivism and the Democratic Party don't have a lot of in common in that Venn diagram.
Medea Benjamin, who is a frequent guest on this show, a well-known peace activist and leader of the organization Code Pink, she wrote an opinion piece in The Guardian. And I want to quote a couple sentences to all of you from it. In 2016, U.S. special operations could be found in 70% of the world's nations. That's 138 countries. A staggering jump of 130% since the days of the Bush administration. That's Barack Obama. That's Obama's administration. Now, looking back at the President Obama's legacy, the Council on Foreign Relations, Mika Zenko, added up the Defense Department's data on airstrikes and made a startling revelation. In 2016 alone, the Obama administration dropped at least 26,171 bombs. This means that every day last year, the U.S. military blasted combatants or civilians overseas with 72 bombs per day. That's 3 bombs every hour, 24 hours a day. If you ask Americans, is the United States engaged in terrorism, meaning dropping bombs on unsuspecting villages and towns and cities? Most Americans would say no. Maybe,
of course.
Maybe the Palestinians are terrorists. Maybe ISIS is terrorists. But the United States is not terrorists. But Walter and Jackie, what other country in 2016, and it probably has increased, would drop 26,000 bombs and carry out military operations in 138 countries. I mean, these are not, this is not me making up these numbers. That's the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah. The reason I think why the Obama administration so dramatically escalated its use of drone warfare, of these sort of like, shadow wars that sort of stay off the front pages is because, you know, they learned the lesson from the Iraq war where, you know, there was a huge, enormous U.S., ground presence, right, occupying Iraq for, at least 8 years. And really, the occupation still continues today. And there was enormous opposition. I mean, the biggest protests in human history happened, against the Iraq war in 2003. And so the Obama administration and Obama himself being a very talented and savvy politician decided that, the best way to pursue fundamentally the same strategy, you know, the war on terror strategy of trying to dominate and assert U.S. hegemony over the Middle East was to carry out what's sort of a 21st century version of gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah, go ahead, Jackie.
I'm sorry. Yeah, there is no other country that commits the scale of military terrorism that we do. And it is military terrorism. I mean, we have 800 military bases around the world carrying out operations in places that American citizens know nothing about, but that affect billions of people on this planet. And that's on top of the bombs that are dropped by drones, which is supposed to be, and this is how the Democratic Party packages drone warfare, that it's less invasive and it's less traumatic on Americans. We don't have to send ground troops, like Walter said, into a conflict area. It's much more sanitized and it's much more precise. This is the argument they use, that drones are more precise and these are surgical strikes. But then explain how we end up bombing busloads of children.
All right, we're going to take a short break. That was the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. We're also talking to Ted Rawl, Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're looking at the big stories of the year. Stay with us for the second half of this discussion.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're talking about the big stories in 2018. We're joined from New York by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com. That's RALL.com. We're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube, and we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome back to the three of you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ted Rawl, when we think about 2018, or we could have said the same about 2017, even 2016 during the election campaign, the issue of America's broken immigration system was front and center, although not in a way that it's actually being addressed. Donald Trump has gone out of his way to use immigrants, immigrant families, especially non-white immigrants, as nothing other than a punching bag for his political campaign. A lot happened this year. We had the death of children in custody. We had the separation of children from their parents. As a conscious policy, we saw the migrant caravan that came to the border. America, under Donald Trump, deployed active duty U.S. military units, Army and Marines, to the border. Anyway, when you think back about 2018 and immigrants, what's your first or second thoughts?
Well, xenophobia usually is a potent force when the economy is weak. And I think that's kind of the big story of 2016, is that Donald Trump acknowledged the pain of the industrial, post-industrial Rust Belt Midwest, and the swing states that gave the presidency to him had suffered a lot. States like Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, those states had been victimized by years, decades of globalization. NAFTA was kind of the last nail in their coffins. I know it well. I'm from Dayton, Ohio, a city that is now ground zero in the national opioid epidemic. And that nativist xenophobic stuff played really well, surprisingly, in states where you wouldn't think it would, because they're not border states. I can tell you as a Midwesterner, Midwesterners really don't traditionally spend a lot of time blaming Mexicans or other brown people for stealing their jobs. But somehow in 2016, Trump kind of hit upon that, and it gave him the presidency. The thing that's been interesting about this narrative is that the media has been very critical of Donald Trump for carrying out an immigration policy that's really, in most ways, a watered-down continuation of what happened under Obama, when immigration activists called him the deporter-in-chief. No president's ever deported as many people as President Obama did during his 8 years. And his policies were vicious in many ways, and unnecessary, and I would say illegal, because they ignored applications for political asylum that were clearly legitimate. I mean, hell, Honduras is a source of a lot of people crossing the southern border into the United States. And Obama tacitly supported a coup against democratically elected president of Honduras, a story that no one ever talks about in the mainstream media. And so these are the traditional, as Ward Churchill would say, chickens coming home to roost, right? I mean, so the hypocrisy is rife here. As usual, the media is criticizing Trump for doing stuff that really his Democratic predecessors did, if not, in a more subtle way. I mean, there just weren't as many cameras at the border. And as was said earlier, I totally agree. Trump is kind of a necessary corrective in that his nasty rhetoric helps shine a spotlight on the truth of American policy. Under Obama, we had fascism with a handsome smile. Now we have fascism with an orange grimace, and it's more appropriate.
That's the voice of Ted Rall. We're also joined by Jacqueline Lookman and Walter Smolarek. As we look at the big stories of 2018, we're talking in this part of the interview about immigration. I want to go back and try to understand, and not just use rhetoric, to try to understand Obama's policy and Trump's policy. Obama justly got the label deporter-in-chief because more people were actually deported during the Obama administration than any other president in the history of the country.
Yes.
But Obama didn't set out, like, with malice. This is my view. With malice, the way Trump has used extreme malice against immigrants. Obama, and this is, I think, very revealing about the Democrats and Obama, but the Democrats in general, when they want to maybe do something that's progressive, like comprehensive immigration reform, or to provide a pathway for legalization and perhaps citizenship for people who arrive without papers, including people who came as young kids, the Dreamers. Now, during the Obama administration's first term, he was laying what he considered to be the groundwork for a comprehensive bargain on immigration with the Republicans. That's what he was actually doing. His administration aggressively enforced immigration law. That was his first years. ICE arrests peaked at more than 300,000 annually in 2010 and 2011, and deportations from American interior, in other words, not of people apprehended near the border, people far away in those ICE raids, that surpassed 200,000 in both of those years, about twice the number reached in 2017. So what Obama's strategy, what the Democrats, what the moderates, what the, quote, progressive strategy was to arrest as many immigrants as possible, deport as many people as possible, and then to be able to say to the Republicans, look, you guys were concerned about border security and are being swamped by undocumented workers. We're deporting them en masse. Now we've come towards you. We've come towards the right-wing position, and now meet us halfway, and then we'll have immigration reform. That's the Democratic Party centrist thinking, that if you capitulate to the right will come over and give you a big kiss, and then you can have a compromise. When in fact, the Republicans and the xenophobes said, thank you very much. Let's now make this a big campaign element and make the argument that actually you're not doing enough to attack undocumented workers. And it backfires again on the Democrats. Instead of taking a principled position about comprehensive immigration reforms and the right of people to have asylum claims and the right of people, of workers, 14 million undocumented workers who pay taxes and go to work and are trying to feed their families. Instead of presenting them in a humane way, they went along with the program.
They did go along with the program. I want to say something here, too. And this is one of the reasons why I'm no longer a Democrat, because the Democrats point the finger at Donald Trump and Republicans as racist because Trump wants the wall and he's calling Central Americans rapists and drug dealers. Maybe he is a racist. But when push comes to shove, the two different policies really are not that different. Obama was the deporter in chief because he really was the deporter in chief. He really did deport that many people. There was never any talk of reform. I mean, we talk about immigration reform, comprehensive reform on this show, and every once in a while, somebody will write a column about it. But there's no movement in the direction of immigration reform on Capitol Hill. It's all about deportations.
Yeah. And the reason the Dreamers even became a thing and why he finally took action with an executive order.
Yeah, he was forced to.
Because they were sitting in at Democratic Party offices. These
exactly.
Young undocumented workers were taking action themselves.
Yeah, I think that's another piece of continuity here, because just like the deportation machine keeps going, whether it's under Obama or under Trump, there's also consistent grassroots opposition. So there were the Dreamers. I mean, it's so heroic what they did. I mean, taking part in a civil disobedience action when you're undocumented, you know, risking deportation, a very high risk of deportation, of course. And then, you know, flash forward to 2018, we also saw major sit-ins across the country this year over the summer against, you know, ICE's just absolute, extreme, cruel, inhumane, disgusting family separation policy. The Occupy ICE movement blossomed all in cities all across the country. People for days and weeks, in some cases, camped out outside of ICE offices, tried to prevent this brutal policy from going forward. And that's something that I think is extremely important to remember, because, you know, politicians like to take credit for any type of positive change that's made, any type of change in policy. You know, maybe the judges and the courts want to do it too. But I think driving a lot of this, or, you know, at least, you know, resisting, like actually truly resisting the Trump administration's policies, were these, you know, courageous sit-in efforts that happened all across the country, targeting not just the Trump administration, but also Democratic Party officials at the local and state level who claim, especially around election time, to be friends of immigrant communities, but in fact are collaborating with ICE. You know, I know a lot of people who are involved in Occupy ICE in Philadelphia, and the city had a contract with ICE where ICE could access this database. It's called PARS. And basically, it's a way to see if anybody was arrested. Oh, are they undocumented? Does this PARS database not include a social security number for them? And then they would be targeted for deportation. So the Democratic Party administrations at a local and state level, in addition to, you know, the previous Obama administration, I think are completely complicit in this. And by the way, as a consequence of the Occupy ICE struggle, the city terminated that contract with ICE.
By the way, and Jacqueline Lookman, I'll draw you back into this discussion. I'm looking at a Bloomberg report about why deportations actually are down during the Trump era. This is an article from May 15th, 2018. The author is Francis Wilkinson. Why Trump deports fewer immigrants than Obama? What's the answer? Sanctuary states and cities are slowing the expulsions. Again, grassroots efforts. Go ahead.
Yeah, grassroots efforts that have turned the pressure onto state and local officials to declare their cities and their states sanctuaries. So that direct action has been key in even pushing. Now, a lot of these city officials and state officials who are declaring these regions sanctuary states and cities are Democrats. This had to be done. This kind of pressure had to be put on a lot of Democratic leaders under the Trump administration. Why didn't they already exist under the Obama administration? And the other issue I have with the way the Democrats approach the immigration issue, because they manipulate it just as much as the Republicans do, they focus solely on Latin American, Central American immigrants, as if those are the only people who come to this country and stay, quote unquote, illegally, which is a term I hate, or without documentation. When the truth is that last year there were at least 600,000 visa overstays. People who came to this country with some kind of visa from many European countries and overstayed their visas. When their visas expired, they just disappeared. Now, there's no effort to build a wall to keep those people out, but there's also no effort on behalf of the Democrats to address that population of quote unquote undocumented people either. So this whole immigration issue is another one of those political footballs that both the Democrats and the Republicans play for, you know, support for their base for different reasons, but it's all the same deflection from actual issue.
That's Jackie Lookman. We're talking to Jackie and Ted Rawl and Walter Smolarek about the big stories in the year. Ted Rawl, you're from New York, right over there in the East River is Ellis Island. At the time, say about 100 years ago or so, people, up to 12 million people came within a 10 or 15 year period through Ellis Island. They didn't have papers.
Including all four of my grandparents.
All four of John's grandparents and a lot of other people's grandparents. They didn't have papers. They basically were processed within a matter of hours if they could prove that they had a family member
that was it.
Living here somewhere, and if they could prove they didn't have smallpox. Last year, at the beginning of 2018, the story, I'm looking at the story from a year ago, Motel 6 gave guest list to ICE agents looking for Latino-sounding names, lawsuit alleges, and it turned out Motel 6 turned over to ICE the names of 9,000 people who stayed at Motel 6.
Just because they were Spanish-sounding names.
Latino-sounding names. Right. So contrast that with the Ellis Island approach to immigration. You can't but draw the conclusion that this is racism.
Yeah, now I know why they leave the light on for you.
Yeah.
But one minor correction, by the way. Ellis Island is actually in New York Harbor, not in the East River. But that's just geography.
And I lived in New York for 30 years. What's the difference between New York Harbor and East River? It all empties into the same spot.
Oh, actually, that's not true. The East River is an estuary, so it actually sucks water out of New York Harbor and goes up. It's a weird one that goes up. Sorry. I'm a geek. No, I love this stuff. So anyway.
Cut Ted's microphone.
But the Hudson that dumps into New York Harbor. Anyway, so the thing I think that's really forgotten about, not only did the United States have a very liberal immigration policy, of course, with the notable exception of the Chinese Exclusion Act during that period in the 19th century, but there's also a big economic impact, and that economic impact was undoubtedly, I mean, historians of every political stripe agree, very positive. The population of the United States expanded, consumer markets expanded, immigrants brought in new ideas, new lines of business, they were industrious, they came up, many immigrants came up with huge new enterprises that pumped billions of dollars in present-day dollars into the economy and tax revenues, and it made the United States the superpower that it is today. Immigration, when we say immigration is our strength, I think most of us on the left think culturally, but it's also economically. I mean, the United States is still a country with a lot of empty room, contrary to what you hear from the right. Just get on a plane, look out the window when you fly from one coast to the other, and you're just going to see this is a country that is roughly the size of China. China has about four times the population. And even China has vast unpopulated areas. Probably two-thirds of the country is mostly desert, not very populous. The United States has a lot of room. We have room for immigrants. It's not, we have tens of millions of vacant homes that we could give to immigrants. You know, it's appalling that we destroyed Syria, for example, but we weren't willing to allow Syrian refugees to come to the United States. So it's good for the country. Even if you're a capitalist and you want to see the economy expand, the fact is that immigration is really not screwing over American workers. What is screwing over American workers is the need to have a class of undocumented workers, because we've had a policy for decades of tacitly leaving borders open, allowing people to overstay their visas in order to intentionally create an undocumented underclass that works at subminimum wage and cannot complain about being cheated out of wages by construction contractors and so on, because they know if they go to the authorities, they might risk deportation. And that's driving everybody's wages down. And so is globalization, and so is automation. Those are the what is hurt. I mean, American workers are suffering, but, you know, in terms of immigrants, they shouldn't be looking at immigrants as their enemies. Immigrants are being used and exploited just as much as native-born American workers are.
Walter Smolarek, I want to turn now to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, a very big achievement for the Obama administration. He had to overcome majority opposition in Congress, in the House and the Senate. An Iran nuclear arms deal. Trump came in. He said it was the worst deal ever. He ripped it up and put new sanctions on Iran, even though Iran was going, you know, adhere to all elements of the JCPOA, the nuclear arms deal. That's a big deal for 2018.
Yeah, it's huge for a number of reasons. I mean, one is just the flagrant disregard for any sort of norms, international norms of diplomacy, right? Where you have this multilateral agreement signed by, you know, the most important world powers in Iran, you know, just concluded, right, a year, 2015. So yeah, you know, 2 years before Trump assumed office. And then Donald Trump comes along and just says, no, we don't like the deal, we're out, right? But the Iran nuclear deal, what it did essentially was offer Iran sanctions relief. And in return, Iran agreed to a number of onerous conditions, related to inspections of its nuclear program, limits on its ability to conduct nuclear research and development. And so what the Trump administration has done since is to try to reimpose these suffocating sanctions on Iran. And by the way, Iran was not violating any of those, accords, right? You know, the International Atomic Energy Agency certified their compliance with the agreement. And so now the Trump administration has returned to the old policy. I think it was Henry Kissinger said, you know, make the economy scream, to try to plunge the country into economic and political chaos that hopefully a pro-U.S. regime could arise from.
Yeah. And Jackie, when we talk about make the economy scream, or Henry Kissinger talked about that, it's really people who scream. It's people, and especially working class and poor people in Iran, who can't buy stuff or who can't access stuff, either food or medicine or water. It's been a huge, huge blow to the Iranian economy, meaning to Iranian people.
This is a page out of a really old playbook, like you mentioned, the make their economy scream quote, to effect regime change around the world. And Mike Pompeo, the current Secretary of State, actually said that that's what they're doing. That's what the United States is doing with Iran in reimposing these sanctions. He blatantly said that Iranian officials have to listen to Washington if they want their people to eat.
That's right. Truly imperial statement. We have 7 minutes left. I want to turn to the other big story. Well, there's several. We didn't cover the wildfires in California, the other natural disasters, so-called. But I want to talk about Russiagate because we must, because it is the dominant part of the political narrative. Just in the recent weeks, Ted Rall, the Senate received reports commissioned by the Senate from an organization called New Knowledge that asserted that the Russian government did indeed meddle in the 2016 election and colluded with the Trump campaign and tried to help Trump get elected, in particular by targeting African-American voters with a particular message, don't vote for Hillary or vote for Jill Stein or something like that. And this came right after the Michael Cohen plea deal and his sentencing, the Michael Flynn plea deal. All of these things kind of came together. Then it turns out that the New Knowledge organization that provided the report to the U.S. Senate was, in fact, a Democratic Party-funded operation that was carrying out covert false flag operations against Roy Moore's campaign in Alabama. And the authors of the New York Times story about this were actually with them in September of last year while they were planning this covert false flag operation that accessed and employed Russian bots for Roy Moore so they could then expose Roy Moore as somehow an extension of Russian meddling. Really something, from my point of view, a kind of story that blows away the narrative once you get into the what's going on behind the scenes.
You can't make this stuff up. Although, like, Lord knows, there's been a lot of made-up news lately, and there's a perfect example. It's so insane. You know, I would have thought personally that you wouldn't need to tie Roy Moore to Russia. I think I would just think the pedophilia accusations would have been enough. It's just like tying Donald Trump to Russia. You would think that just the insanity would be enough, but apparently not. You know, and the thing is, what I keep coming back to the basics on the Russiagate thing. First, we're still waiting for evidence. It's been years. Still zero evidence. And then, has anybody told the Democrats that the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore? The Cold War is no more? This is coasting on a narrative that the vast majority of American voters who are alive today and voting don't even remember. I mean, if you're 30 years old, you know, you don't remember. You know, you didn't do duck and cover. You weren't worried about the Russian bear. It must be so bizarre for anyone under 40, really, to hear these narratives. And they must be asking themselves, why are we supposed to be afraid of Russia? We've never been at war with Russia. The only time that we've had a military relationship with Soviet Union was as an ally during World War II. You know, it just seems like I'm baffled by the messaging. I mean, the Democrats haven't gotten much traction from this at all. And for a party that seems singularly incapable of staying on message for any length of time, the one time that they managed to keep a narrative going for over 2 years, it's a narrative that just doesn't go anywhere, has no traction whatsoever in the polls, barely hits single digits in lists of people's concerns, and yet they just keep at it. I admire their consistency, but it's really stupid.
That's Ted Rall. Walter, one thing about what the U.S. government or the media or the Republicans and the Democrats are all saying, Russia meddled. Again, as Ted Rall said, we're still waiting for evidence. If we get it, we're going to talk about it, but we can't talk about the evidence that doesn't exist. But what did happen in 2018, and I think this is fundamentally important and sort of beneath the headlines, is the U.S. government, the Pentagon, under the leadership of James Mattis, reorganized U.S. military doctrine targeting Russia and China for major power conflict, not the war on terror, not against Al-Qaeda or ISIS as the priority. So aren't we just preparing the population through a media campaign demonstrating animus or generating animus and hostility against the new enemy?
Yeah, it's such a historic shift. I mean, the war on terror, quote unquote, which is, you know, obviously a misnomer, but, you know, the war on terror strategy for enforcing U.S. domination all around the world. I mean, that's been the dominant thing for, you know, since 9/11 for almost 20 years. And now the Pentagon is saying, well, look, you know, the world isn't exactly how we envisioned it after the Soviet Union was overthrown. And it's not this unipolar era of the United States being able to dictate every little thing around the world. There are these other powerhouses that are beginning to develop economically and gain more diplomatic clout. And they have, you know, some sort of military might, nothing approximating the Pentagon, of course. And they've identified China. I think China is the primary one, but Russia, too, absolutely, explicitly in this new national security strategy as the big obstacles to the United States going forward. And the 21st, basically what they're saying is that the 21st century is going to be defined not by the domination of the United States, but by the fierce and unbelievably dangerous struggle by the United States to prevent any rivals from arising. That's not a very persuasive argument to average people in the United States that the U.S. banks and corporations and the Pentagon needs to run everything. So they have to come up with this other narrative, the idea that U.S. democracy was hijacked, quote unquote, by Russia, again, without evidence, without conclusive evidence, and make that the basis for this new period of confrontation.
40 seconds left. Jackie Lookman, the U.S. government is trying to cut food stamps for poor people, is cutting Medicaid for poor people. And at the same time, with the new national security strategy, giving the Pentagon another $60 billion per year, and they gave them a $60 billion increase the year before. Warfare, as Dr. King said, is also a war against poor people. 30 seconds left. You take us out.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is where the GOP and the DNC share this the responsibility for this, and not pointing to the facts of where our money goes, how much money we're actually spending on the military industrial complex, and what that means for working class and poor people, and the kind of services and benefits we can't get because we'd rather spend money on killing people in foreign countries than feeding and giving health care to people in our own.
That was Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. You can listen to Jacqueline on this show every Wednesday and Friday when we talk about the big news of the week. We're also joined from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com, R-A-L-L.com. And we were joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.